So what a fantastic audience. Yeah, I've changed the title every time you asked me, so that's a lot. It was always about the same thing anyway. I want to contribute to the discussion about observability, observables, the kind of question that Don was discussing yesterday. And I'm going to do two steps. First, I will present another set of possible observables in quantum gravity, which are in the general family that Don was talking about generically, but not any specific kind he described. The characteristic is that they have to do with infinity. So they're bulk observable in the sense that they are not at the boundary of the whole space-time. But there's a boundary observable in another sense. I'll say exactly what I mean in a moment. This is pretty blah, blah, blah. You know, these things could be... But then I think that the blah, blah, blah makes sense if you try to do something about it. So I actually want to show you how to use these ideas to make a concrete calculation in quantum gravity. So something that in principle, theoretically, might have to do with something that we measure. Quantum gravitational phenomena we might measure in our universe. The actual calculation is not completed. This is complicated. So we have a preliminary result, which is obviously wrong. I don't know why. But that's where we are. So that's what I know. And I think what is interesting is not so much the actual result of the calculation, which is going to evolve, I think, as soon as we learn to do it better. The fact that one can make the tentative claim that one can make predictions if you have a quantum theory of gravity, whatever is your preferred one, about something that can be measured, and you can talk about these things without need at all to go out to infinity. So this is a slide that at the beginning of the month there was a discussion here, what are the problems. I'm not going to go through that, but all what I'm saying is related to a lot of the questions that Ted Jacobson was carefully writing down on the blackboard a month ago. Especially, a lot of these questions have to do, I don't work in ADF, CFT, I don't work in holography at all. But a lot of questions here were of the sort, what can you tell about the bulk physics itself? And that's what I want to discuss. And let me just start up front with a very simple observation. This is just to introduce. Nothing complicated, nothing quantum here. Just classical GR. If you have a collapsing star with mass m, this is a Penrose diagram. So when it gets radius to m, there is an apparent horizon, some kind of horizon that falls, let's say at least an apparent horizon, a trapping horizon here, then it goes down. And suppose you don't look at what happens after some space-like surface, where the curvature becomes Planckian, where quantum gravity should come in, where we don't know what's really happening. But you just stay on the classical region when we think that the classical or quantum theory on a given geometry region works. Well, if you just look at the volume of the black hole, meaning the volume of a space-like hypersurface inside the black hole, it's large. This is a simple fact in classical GR, which haven't been, I'm sure that many of you know that, but it has been much stressed. In fact, it's very large. That's an expression for the volume, where the volume inside this sphere here is given by m squared times v. V is a time lapse of sensor collapse. So it grows linearly with the time. It's huge. It's enormous. Inside the stellar black holes that we see really in the universe around us, there is, in a precise sense, an enormous volume, finite but enormous volume, right, which depends on how long ago they collapsed. A volume large enough that many of you like holography very much and think that there are a finite number of degrees of freedom determined by the area. If there are a finite number of freedom determined by the area inside, then standard quantum theory is a little bit of trouble. The standard quantum theory here needs a lot of degrees of freedom. I mean, forgetting quantum mechanics, forgetting Planck scale, just larger than Planck scale. And even if you fold in Hawking radiation, suppose there's Hawking radiation here, so this actually shrinks. So at some later time, the radius is much smaller than 2m. Suppose you are just coming toward Planck and radius, but not quite here. Then the volume is still of the order m to this power here. It's still larger than what would be allowed by your holography if you just assume that there is at least 1 degree of freedom per centimeter cubed for a sufficiently large block. Why am I saying these things? Well, first, because I would like to get an answer to that. Maybe you have an answer to that. But especially because I want to do physics here. Suppose I want to do physics here. I want to know, say, if I do something here and make a measurement here, what happens? This has nothing to do with what I see in square plus or square minus, right? I want to do physics here. That's what I'm trying to do. Now, these are a couple of slides which are totally useless. I just say things like...
Sorry, can I ask? I agree that the volume is big and some slicing you might write down, but is there any kind of invariant way...
There is a technical thing behind that. There is an invariant way of defining the volume inside. It is essentially the largest. The largest spherical symmetric one, which is what gives you the volume
the largest spherical symmetric.
Yeah. So, by the way, so there's a related question, and that is, you know, if you have a large volume, you might think there are a large number of possible quantum states, but, you know, can I excite all of these quantum states? And there are additional restrictions.
And I'm sort of suggesting, look, in this large volume, it's true that I don't have much time if I'm here, right, of course. Just going to very, very fast fall into the quantum region, and that's later. But for a while, I can make measurements here. And why should just standard field theory go wrong there? Maybe it does, or maybe it doesn't. I don't just want to put them.
Carlo, are you pretending that you solved the problem of collapse in the interior?
No. I haven't pretended.
What is this? How do you compute this volume if you don't know the magnitude inside?
Oh, I do it this is a collapsing star, so outside is Schwarzschild.
But you're assuming spherical symmetry.
Schwarzschild, spherical symmetry.
Oh, assuming spherical symmetry and Schwarzschild.
Yeah, it's a calculation of Schwarzschild. You ask what is the largest base-like surface with given spherical symmetry.
There is an issue because there's this sort of instabilities, right? DKL
behavior. Yeah. You might think this is not the right solution.
Nothing settles down inside. This is so
close to singularity that you have to really worry about that too much, I think.
Absolutely. But I'm much before any large curvature region. So, but this was just there's a big space there. So I think there is sort of agreement here that in some sense quantum gravity is not a local quantum field theory in the sense of Hagg, in the sense of operator associated to arbitrary small space-time region, for two reasons. One is just one which I think you all know very well, the observables in a space-time coordinate points are not gauge invariant. And also another reason which have to do, I mean, I come from loop quantum gravity, from the discreteness of space-time. If you come from string theory, I put Gabriele here because I was thinking of the old Veneziano, Amati, Cefaloni arguments that you cannot test arbitrary small regions in string theory, naively, because you excite the freedom of the string if you put a lot of energy. So then there are two things to do. Either you go to asymptotics, so you try to face the problem. And I want to suggest a way to say it's, face the problem directly, and that I'm coming closer to what I'm going to say. And let me introduce it this way. In quantum mechanics, the way I like to think about quantum mechanics, each of us has a different way of thinking about quantum mechanics. But even Jim, in his last paper, talks about the observables, the observer in quantum mechanics. The way I want to think about quantum mechanics is I'm interacting with the system, or some external physics interacting with the system, and the theory tells me what happened to the interaction. That is local in the sense that it's on the boundary between the system. And in general relativity, there is also a notion of locality, which is that, general relativity is about region of space-time and how they interact with one another. Let me just combine the two and identify a quantum system with a space-time region, finite. So I'm going to consider finite space-time regions with a boundary, and this is the kind of things which I want to discuss.
So that's a fairly semi-classical notion, right? How do you define that when, say, the geometry is strongly fluctuating?
I'm going to get that. Will be all the following things. So at the end of the day, just to anticipate, the idea is that there will be quantum states around and transition associated to the boundary and transition amplitude associated to the 4D regions. And Bianca after me will have a similar setting to a lot of what she's doing. Now, let me start classically, just to clarify things classically. The key object here is a Hamilton function. Hamilton function, assume you'll know what it is, on the next slide there's just a definition. It was introduced by Hamilton in a fantastic paper in which there is this marvelous sentence. He says, the function of Mr. Lagrange defines the problem, the function of Mr. Hamilton solves the problem. So what's Hamilton? Feynman was in love with Hamilton function, of course. If you look at the beginning of Higher Leaves, it's all about that. So what's a Hamilton function? You have take a finite dimensional system from T and T prime. It starts at Q, it ends at Q prime. Let's hear, for the sake of the discussion here, imagine there's a single solution that goes from Q to Q prime in this time. Call the solution in this finite matter, compute the action, and the Hamilton function is the value of the action as a function of tq, t prime, q prime. Okay? So it's a function of the boundary variables t, t prime, q, q prime of the system. And if you have it, it has a lot of beautiful properties. The solution of Hamilton-Jacobi equation, special solution of Hamilton-Jacobi equation, if you take the derivative with respect to q, you get p. If you take the derivative with respect to t, you get the energy, all that stuff. And it has a brother, of course, in quantum mechanics, which we know very well, and it's a brother of it because it's a propagator, it's this object here, because the exponential of the propagator to the first order in one over h bar is just related to the Hamilton function like that, and of course is the object you can write as a path integral if you have a definition of that. Now, first observation. Look what happens. If you want to do generativity, the difficulty of generativity is that there are no local observables, so there is invariance, right? In terms of T, there's an invariant, there's a reprimandization in T under which the action is invariant. So let me rewrite the system here, this is a mnemonic oscillator, in the manner in which generativity is written. So instead of having Q as a function of T, I have a Q and T as a function of a parameter, with an action defined by this Lagrangian, which is invariant under reprimandization. And let me write the Hamilton function. And then magic, the Hamilton function is not a function of T and T tau, of tau and tau prime. So it's not a function of the initial and final value of the parameter. It's just independent of that, which is a simple two-line derivation. So the Hamilton function of this formulation and of this formulation are the same. Now, what I'm saying, I'm trying to drive home this lecture, I'm going to use this. If we don't know how to do general relativistic physics, instead of trying to translate our system as much as possible into non-general relativistic language. Let's take the general relativistic formulations that works for all systems and use that for. And the prototypical example of the general relativistic, the quantity of standard classical mechanics that survives in general relativistic case is the Hamilton function and the propagator. Because if I do the quantum theory of that, I do the path integral in Q of tau and T of tau, it turns out again that it's independent of tau and tau prime. In fact, it's the same object as before. Now, of course, there's no evolution in T. It's just the sort of formally the projector on the Wheeler-DeWitt equation of the quantization of the system. This is a Hamiltonian constraint and so on and so forth. Now I want to use this. This is all fine. Uncontroversial and simple in finite dimension. Now, let's think of field theory. In a field theory, there is an object, which is more or less defined, depending on what you mean by being defined. But for instance, it's used in lattice gauge theory a lot by some people, which is the boundary function. Again, so you fix the boundary variables, and then you integrate in the bulk, but the bulk is not in field. And you get a function of the values of the field on the boundary. And this can be computed in two dimensions, can be computed explicitly, can be computed for finite, for free theories, for instance, for a large for some shapes of sigma. Sigma is too complicated, you don't see.
Are you integrating out fields both inside and outside?
No, only inside. Only inside with a fixed boundary.
But is the theory a theory that...
Yes. The theory is a theory that is outside.
So the other fields are just kind of sitting there?
I took away a nice equation which would have... suppose you want the two-point function. So you're integrating all these fields, outside and inside, and on the boundary.
Okay.
Now, let me break this integration in the integration of the outside field, integration of the inside field, and the boundary integration. And then I can write the two-point function as just a simple integration on the boundary of the result of the integration outside, which I call the boundary state, and the result of the integration of inside.
Okay.
So
you are integrating over all of
those. Oh, yeah, sure. No. Changing the theory. That's right.
Although at this point you've broken diff invariance by selecting.
I'm going to get to this. That's the big question.
Does sigma have a definite signature? Or
sorry?
Does sigma have a definite signature? Is it space life, time life, mix?
No. Here I'm thinking that this is. Later on, I will restrict to cases in which it's all space like, it's sort of like that. But for the moment, no, you can take this. For the lattice gauge theory, they do Euclidean. But if they did. Now the key point, of course, imagine you could do that. Imagine you had a quantum theory of a different most invariant theory, you could do that. And then, of course, this thing here would be independent of sigma for the same reason as the Hamilton function and the propagator is independent of tau type prime in the previous thing. What does this mean? I mean, how does sigma disappear then? Well, that's a physicist version of that. If you make a measurement, suppose you're at CERN, you're a particle coming in, some scattered region, particle coming out. What do you need? You need some detector that measures the particle, the field, but then you need where this thing is, you know, the momentum, the position, and the time. But the moment, the position and time are just function of the gravitational field. So if you know phi, the gravitational field, on the boundary, you don't need extra information to say where the boundary is. That's what diffeomorphism invariance is all about. The relative position of things is not in terms of the coordinates, but is in terms of the gravitational field, which tell me what is the distance between these things. So in general relativistic theory, distance and time measurement, of course, field measurement. And the reference to Jean here is that, in a sense, what I'm doing here is a subclass of the kind of observable that Jean considers when he does in some of the histories with some subclass of histories. I'm saying let's consider all the histories which have a given value on the boundary, and in a general relativistic theory, in a gravitational theory, this is sufficient for giving me all the possible relevant information about the boundary. I don't need the boundary geometry in addition because it's written in the boundary state.
But phi is the boundary field, the boundary data,
yeah,
is on some space, one lower dimensional space.
Three dimensional space. Let's talk about
that. That's an abstract sphere, say, independent of how it's embedded in the space time.
There's no space time. That's all there is. I mean, there's some geometry. You want to know the value of the function of a large sphere or small sphere, just put a value of the gravitational field, which makes it large or small. Now, as Tom was saying before, we don't need, let's think about the propagator again. We don't need to just consider a propagator with Q and Q prime, maybe eigenstate states, which are eigenstate of the position. In principle, we can put P and P prime, or any state, psi and psi prime. So we might be interested in things like that, which in our optimization invariant theory are, if you want, formally, very formally, matrix element of the projector on the solution of the Wheeler-Witt equation between two arbitrary states. In a field theory, and in particular in general relativity, I don't care very much who is the past states and who is the future state. In fact, I want a formalism that ignores that. So for the moment, let me just simply take the sort of the past field of space and the future field of space with the tensor product and view this as a bra on a cat, which lives in the boundary field of space being the tensor product of initial finite Hilbert spaces.
Do you need some kind of time reversal that you're brought into?
Yeah,
I'm sorry?
Do you need, what your, it looks like you have different.
I need a star. I need a star.
You need a star.
Yeah, I need a star. I'm missing a star.
So you introduce one via some time reversal symmetry or some such thing? How do you define the star?
I need, the situation I'm going to find myself is not that I have H in, H out, and I have to go to I have to get the boundary space, but I have the boundary space, and I have to ask myself if and how I can divide into the tensor product of two. And it's that point that this question becomes valid.
But the left-hand side of that equation was complex, and it depended which was on which side.
Yeah, there is a star here. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Similar.
Sorry.
So there's a star.
In spin forms, it's sometimes real.
Sometimes?
It's real, the amplitudes.
But
which is exactly the orientation.
So this is just an advertisement of our two books. The last one I wrote with Francesca, in which all this is done in detail. So this is a short summary. But let me make this concrete, because otherwise it's just blah, blah, blah. So I'm going to make it concrete in two short steps. One is I'll just flash the equations of loop quantum gravity, because that's the theorem I'm going to use. So just a couple of transparencies about loop quantum gravity. I don't want to convince you that you should start working in loop quantum gravity. I will certainly fail. But that's the theory I'm going to use. Then what is interesting here is how to use that theory for doing calculation and for... So that's loop quantum gravity in its covariant version in one single transparency. So all you want to know about loop quantum gravity is here. So how is it defined? Well, it's defined two steps, the kinematics and the dynamics, so to say. The kinematics is the boundary, which is a Hilbert space. The Hilbert space is defined like Fock space, so step by step. So no particle, one particle, Hilbert space, two particle. The Hilbert space of all states up to n particles, then it is a suitable n going to infinity limit. So here is similar. The Hilbert space is nothing particularly strange. It's the same kind of things that come out of lattice gate theory. The algebra of observables, and that relates sort of to what Steve is doing. The algebra observable is not in any sense a local algebra observable, because the operator localized the dependent L, and L is the operator sits on the state itself. The where of the operators is given by the state themselves. It's like in field theory. You can have an n-particle state, say that particle has certain position and a certain momentum, and now you want to ask what is the momentum of that particle. That's a well-defined question, you can pose it, but it's not something that you can easily write in terms of fields, local observables. Right. Because it's the where is where the particle is. So it's something like that is going on here. In other words, if you want, this is like a lattice gate theory in a lattice, but the lattice is not a fixed lattice. The lattice is given by the excitation of space-time itself. So the quantum particle, the particles here are the space-time positions themselves, which are discrete. I'll say in a moment. This is very vague, but I just want to, I'm not doing a summary of loop quantum gravity here. And then transition amplitude are given by, so given a state here, I can compute transition amplitude, and are given by some SU2, SL2C integrals. There is some SL2C unitary representation theory here. These are the matrix elements in the canonical basis of SL2C unitary representation for the infinite dimensional ones. And you get some number. Now, what you do with that? First of all, you look for the classical limit. And so the theory is defined by order by order in some truncation, which include more and more degrees of freedom. At each order, there are some theorems that tells you that the h-bar going to zero limit connects to a truncation of general relativity, and more precisely to a Regge truncation of general relativity. So how? Well, again, in the same sense in which the propagator connects to the Hamilton function. And generativity, in principle, we have, nobody knows how to compute it, but you have a well-defined Hamilton function of generativity. If you give me the free geometry on a closed boundary, say boundary like that, and you knew how to write the Hamilton function, you would have solved the Einstein equations, of course. Okay. Now, in a regular theory, at least this is more defined, and regular on a given triangulation is the h going to zero limit of this transition amplitude here. And of course, you have to take this continuous limit here, and the theory is in principle defined defined here, of course. So in this sense, there is we know something about the classical limit, the space-time discrete entropy, the old one of quantum gravity, of loop quantum gravity, and the main sort of result is that this transition amplitude I gave you, they're finite to all orders. The ultraviolet finite and infrared finite to all orders in I think I'll skip this on the, because this is going to come out. Because there's a name up there.
Is it fair to say that while they're finite, there's no sense in which it's understood that the theory is unitary? So normally in quantum field theory, we'd want to establish, you know, one of the properties we'd go for is unitarity. So I just wanted to point out, is it, it's not something that's been really addressed at this level, or what's the status of that?
This is going to open a long, long discussion, which I prefer to postpone it. So I don't want to make any claim about unitarity at this point. So
maybe, well, another question that may lead to long is,
this, of course, could open up, right? You can discuss what about loop quantum gravity, but that's not what I want to talk about here.
Good to have more of that discussion, but obviously we've got limited time now. But another question is, so with regard to the assertion that we have, say, IR finiteness, does one understand well enough how one matches on to the, say, usual approximate field theory picture that one can see how this is resolving the usual IR problems?
The UV, yes. The IR, no. IR, no. And the IR finite, in fact, is not in that in the version I gave you, because I'm cheating, but in the version with cosmological constant. And what happens here is that the cosmological constant works effectively as an effective IR regulator.
Which
positive.
Positive.
Absolutely. Only exists with a positive cosmological constant.
De Sitter-like, you're saying.
Huh?
De Sitter-like.
De Sitter.
Yeah.
De Sitter. Yes.
Well,
I mean, it's a, yeah, it bounds the distance to which you, and the way it comes out is a limitation of the sum here. It just runs out to some value.
There, as we've been discussing, there are possibly even more severe IR problems. So it would be good to maybe chat more about that later.
I'm not sure they're the same IR problems. They might, I don't know. So
it's kind of a soft graviton problem that becomes even more pronounced.
So physically, this is in the sum of the geometries. Even if you have a finite boundary, you can have arbitrary large geometries inside that continued.
No, but as you go to the future. But anyway, I don't want to derail your talk too much.
Can I just ask one question about the formalism? Usually, you made this analogy, the lattice gauge theory, there's a large degree of choice as to what the amplitudes are, because you can choose different lattice Hamiltonians or lattice actions. I don't see any of that here. Are you claiming there's none? It's canonically fixed to be these?
No, there's no claim whatsoever of that sort here. In fact, let me put it this way. It's not easy to play around and change without losing Lorentz invariants, without losing this, without Lorentz invariants. But there's no claim about uniqueness in any sense. And the way at least some part of the community this side have been working is that, is there a definition of amplitudes such that, you know...
So you're saying this is one ansatz that satisfies...
That satisfies property. Right. There's no. I'll skip that unless it comes out. Maybe I'll just say a word.
Pearl? I mean, in your classical limit, you say you get the Reggie action. You get a manifold automatically? Is the spin network defined on a manifold, or is it just some general?
A manifold in this, you get a piecewise, something like a piecewise flat manifold. if you want. If you want to associate an interpretation, a geometrical interpretation to Regia, you can say, well, there are simplices, flat simplices attached to one another with curvature on the.
I would regard that as a piecewise linear manifold.
Right? Yeah.
It's usually
you can interpret this way. Here is similar with some technical differences are called twisted geometries, but it's a similar idea.
Thanks.
Oh yeah, here I was kept hesitating. I think I do have a little bit of time. There is a huge difference with lattice gauge theory, which I want to point out because I call it DIT invariant because I got the core of this from some work by Bianca. If you discretize a standard system, this is a harmonic oscillator, you discretize it, you write the path integral, as you all know, you have to take two limits, the number of steps going to infinity and the lattice space going to zero, in order to recover the propagator, the thing which is, we know from the continuous theory. Now you can trade the lattice space going to zero to some, you can change variables from small q to large q to a moving a constant here omega to its critical value. If you do that, take the same things, write it in a reproduction invariant way, do the same thing, and look how magic happens. This happens all the time. A squared a disappears. So in the path integral of that, you take a certain number of steps. If you want to find this the propagator, you just have to take the number of steps to infinity and not a critical a value to a constant to a critical value. This happens in all the decent discretization of these invariant systems, and it's core reasons for which ultraviolet is different in the from standard field theory. Standard field theory, ultraviolet means going small with in x and t. But here it's DR gauges, so there's nothing
but
to do.
Isn't the gauge, I mean, this statement is just the gauge statement. I mean, it's just the theory is the quantization variant. You can scale time, and that's...
So it's just that. It's
a quantum field gauge invariance and has no physical...
It is exactly. Okay, it is exactly that. Okay. The result is that this equation is true, where there's no constant to be taken to a critical value. Okay, so let me go now to the second part. I'll be fast. I'm going to use all this and present you a calculation of what happens in the quantum region. Okay, and I want to start with giving you a piece of a technical result in classical GR, which was enormously surprising to me when it came out. If I tell you, you don't believe it, but it's true, and I'll show you why. So the statement is the following. There is a metric, which is written here, but I'm illustrating it. This is its Penrose diagram, which is an exact solution of the Einstein equations everywhere except in this gray region here. So let me illustrate it here. So it's Minkowski here. Then you have a shell that comes in. We took a null shell because it's easier to do a calculation. So it's a Schwarzschild here. The shell enters its, the shell has a certain mass. It enters its horizon, it's 2n. So this is a trapping horizon. And so far, so good. But the point is that there's an exact solution of Einstein equation, which you can continue here, which here is still Minkowski, is still Schwarzschild. Here's a white hole, here's an outgoing shell, and this is Minkowski again. Now, if you have, either you knew that already, or if you have studied enough geometry, you say, no, this is impossible. Why you say this is impossible? Because we all know that you can put the outside of a black hole and a white hole together, but the black hole is after, and the white hole is before. And I'm saying you that is the other way around. So what is the trick? The trick is that the metric here is indeed isometric to this, but locally, and not globally. So it's not a one-to-one. And in fact, the map is the following. If you take this part here of Schwarzschild, you can isometrically map it into this one. And if you take this one, you can isometrically map into this one. So it's like when you take a piece of paper, you know, you take a cone with not a positive, but a negative curvature, you cut it, you open up, it's in fact isometric to a flat space, but there's an overlap. So it's not one-to-one. Okay? So you can construct, there's nothing wrong, construct a metric with this. You just have to go through this trick, which I call the finger. You just cut this, open up, and stick a piece of something inside we don't know, which is where quantum theory is supposed to happen. So what does this mean? It means...
Was it a solution to vacuum Einstein equations, you said?
It is an exact solution of vacuum Einstein equation in all this white region, white region, white region. Here is not vacuum because there is an incoming shell.
So your shell violates some energy conditions when you... Your shell eventually violates some energy conditions when you time reverse it. Yeah.
The shell violates the energy condition only when it enters in the quantum region. In the quantum region, of course, you can invent something new, but it violates the energy conditions.
Also,
but outside, the shell doesn't violate anything.
Sir, so your quantum region has some... I assume you haven't modified, so that gray region is not obeying Einstein equation, right?
That's in the gray region. I wrote a metric, but it's not a solution for Einstein equation. In fact, the metric I wrote is pretty much.
And also, you insist that there's some causality in this diagram.
Some?
There is some sense of causality in the diagram still.
Yeah.
So it's weird that some tip of that gray region, if you look into the past, you actually don't see any high energy quantities, and you still need to violate.
The tip of this goes out to 2M.
Yeah, so that tip, that's in the region where you need to modify Einstein equation. But
I'm coming to that. Yeah, I'm coming to that. That's in two slides. So you're asking me, is the gray region leaking out the regime where we expect quantum effects to be? I'm going to address this in a moment.
But differently, you could have some stress tensor there. And maybe, are you going to say more about the kind of stress tensor you would need to geometry like that?
Not as much as I would like be able to, but...
in fact, I mean, when you say it's a solution of the Einstein equation, you take that metric and you compute the union.
I take this metric... I take this metric, I compute the union, I get zero here, I get zero here, I get zero all over, I get exactly here the stress energy tensor of an incoming fall, and also the one here. Here I get something which has no physical, decent physical interpretation, and which violates the energy conditions.
Okay.
So it's not trivial at all that there is a let me put it physically. Generativity, classical generativity is compatible with a star collapsing, entering some black hole, something happening, but something happening in a compact region, in a small region of space-time, slightly larger than 2M. And then, from that, say, quantum region, the shell bouncing out and coming out, it's past horizon. It's white hole horizon.
You're violating the energy condition outside the horizon.
Yes, in the gray region goes out, leaks outside the horizon. By a pretty bit, but it needs to, otherwise this would be impossible. Otherwise, you go up to the standard one. So,
just to check, the dotted line really is R equals 2M for this. And
the dot is R to M or the trapping horizon. If there's some Hawking radiation, which I'm not considering at all here, yes.
It's the R to 2M.
Quick question. Is it flat space up in the top corner?
Yeah, it's flat space here. But
this pulse has positive energy?
It's like a ball. Is that a ball that bounces up?
Okay.
It's just the standard. If you want, this is T symmetric, right?
Okay, yeah,
that's good. It's T minus T symmetric, which doesn't mean that the energy. Okay. What's nice about that? Now you have the metric. If you don't look at the quantum thing. You can compute the proper time here and the proper time here. This is Minkowski. You have a preferred frame in Minkowski because it's where the frame where this happens. So the time from here to here is proportional to the mass. The time from here to here. The time from here to here. The time along a constant radius here is given by that formula. An easy calculation in Charlton geometry, where 2R is in Minkowski the time it takes to go in and go out. So that's 2R. Plus a term, delta is small, So this is negative. So plus the term, which is very, very large, because delta is very, very small. Delta has to do with how it really can be. So this can be very, very large. So if take a star, m of the order of a star, then the time inside for this process is a millisecond. The time outside for this process is a billion years. It's an order of a billion years. So suppose for a moment, I don't want you to believe that, but suppose for a moment that this would describe a black hole. And what is a black hole? A black hole is a star that collapses, bounces out, goes through some quantum things, bounces out in a very, very short time. The time roughly, the light time of its radius, its diameter. But since there is this huge time delay due to the fact that there is a big gravitational potential here, from the outside, this is a very slow process. From the outside, like always in general relativity, you see it's a slow motion. So here's a picture of a black hole. A black hole is a star that collapses and bounces out, seeing an extremely slow motion because of a huge time dilation. Well, I have to get to quantum gravity, so I'm so now we want to know how much is this time. So evaluate delta. How much is this bounce time? How much this is longer than that? And we have a number of ways of trying to guess it. First guess, this is what Don Marov came out as soon as I told him that. Oh, of course it's the exponential in the mass. Why? Well, because this is a tunneling. You have a classical metric, a history, which is not a solution of the equation of motion, it's a solution at some point, some other point, so it violates. So this, of course, can happen in quantum, which is an effective description of a tunneling phenomenon. Tunneling phenomenon is a non-annihilating h-bar, is e to the action over h-bar. H-bar is h-bar g, so the Planck mass, so you want a mass upstep, one square. So in fact, I need an m square. So it's going to be huge, right? I think that this first guess is wrong. I don't want to argue with that too much, because this is not really a tunneling. A tunneling is a tunneling space, it's a tunneling time, and the time structure is completely different here. There's time infinity, a time there. But that's one possibility. Of course, if this was the case, it doesn't mean that it would really be so long, because the hole would shrink because of Hawking radiation before that. So it would become small, so this would become small. So this phenomenon could still happen, but roughly at m cubed, when the black hole is small. Second hypothesis. Let me read the firewall paper and say, well, I don't believe in firewalls, so some hypothesis must be wrong in the of the theorem. The theorem is right. So something should be violated with respect to the hypothesis, at least at page time, so order m cubed. So suppose that this is what happens. Then this should happen in time m cubed.
Carl, a question? Coming back to the first, I mean, if you actually just did this calculation within general relativity, there's no large curvature, so you might think that would be the correct way to do the calculation. And then wouldn't you get the first answer because you're basically getting something involving the size of the black hole over the Planck length?
I tried to do this calculation, I failed, I couldn't. Because, you mean using the standard way of computer tunneling, or?
Well, actually, I mean, I would mean by
the Euclidean action?
No, actually, I would look in the Willow-DeWitt equation. You know, look at actual WKB solutions to the Willow-DeWitt equation.
Ah, well, that's, that's so view it as, I failed. Because I could show you what I did and I couldn't do it. Now, this is my favorite answer. This comes to the question that some of you asked before. This equation, this metric, violates the classic Einstein equation also in a region where you wouldn't expect it naively because the curvature is small, okay? Which is the tip region here, okay? Now, that's true, but if you have a small, okay, so here the curvature is small, so quantum gravitational effects are small, but they're not zero, because curvature is not zero. And there's a long parameter, which is time. If you stay at a constant time, go close here, along here you stay at constant time, you stay at constant radius at a certain value of the curvature for a very, very long time. So the correct parameter, I would say, or I would try to guess. It's not curvature, but the curvature of type time. So you have quantum gravity effects either because the curvature is large, or for a small curvature, the effects are small, but they can pile up in a long time. So if you use this as a condition to tell you when you expect this possible sort of violation of the classicality here, so this tells you how this can go out from to n, what you get is a time m square. Now, all this is blah blah blah. Can we make a calculation? And I want to claim that we can make a calculation. Yeah.
Maybe you're gonna say, I mean, is there some sense in which the curvature is all localized at that one orbital point?
No. The curvature grows as 1 over r, what is called, cube?
I'm sorry, you can't localize it.
As it should, with the radius. No. So can we make a calculation? And that was the bottom line of all the story. Yes, let's make a calculation. I want a transition from this surface here, sort of before the quantum region, which is the surface here, the Kruskal extension, to the surface here. Now here nothing happens, it's just the transition from here to here. So I have a bounded finite region of space-time, I know the metric in the past, I know the metric in the future, I want to know what is the probability amplitude to go from one to the other. And it's not too hard because I can, at the surface, I know its intrinsic geometry, I know its extrinsic geometry. Same here, and in fact, it's the same intrinsic geometry because it's T-symmetric, and the extrinsic geometry is the same with the minus sign because of T-invariance. So let me use now the equation of loop quantum gravity to write a state which is a semi-classical state, a coherent state, and represent the geometry intrinsic, extrinsic here, one here, fold it in my equations, put it there, go to the most brutal truncation that I can do. I get some complicated integral over SL to CSU2. This is going to depend on two quantities, one which knows about the intrinsic geometry, and one which knows about the extrinsic geometry. The intrinsic geometry essentially knows about the size, the spin is the area, which is a mass, the black hole. The extrinsic geometry is the other quantity, which if you look carefully at the geometry of that, is exactly what depends on the delta here. So this, you can compute this amplitude, and we did compute this amplitude, and then you can say when this amplitude, when the modulus square of this amplitude is only 1, is when this is possible. Sure. If you write this, you can just finish, you get a relation between J and K, which is a relation between the mass and the time, and we did it, and we get T m log m.
So are you saying you're filling in the region between the yellow and green, the missing piece, with not with some exotic stress tensor, but sort of doing a loop quantum gravity?
Yeah. Now,
okay, so exactly. So no exotic matter.
Exactly. Now I forget completely the metric that I wrote there before. Mm-hmm. It was just a tentative way of filling this.
And just figure out how.
I forget, and I just say from here to here, it's a quantum calculation at this state, what's the amplitude of going from this to that? The amplitude is going to depend on the parameters, and it's going to be large if some parameter satisfies some relation, and this gives me a mass time.
So, is the space being described by a spin network state that's got many vertices, or is it just...
No. This is a brutal truncation in which you have a very simple spin network. That's why it's probably wrong.
What's the nature of that spin network? Is it one simplex?
It's a super simple triangulation. Basically, what's going from here to here is you have a geometry with an intrinsic and extrinsic geometry,
right.
And you flip the extrinsic. Okay.
And is the state, you said it's a coherent state, so it's got a spread of both metric and extrinsic curve.
Yeah, so you can play on which, but whatever you do, you always get regarding this. So there's an extra parameter that doesn't matter.
So this is like an exotic sort of star. It's similar, I think, as we've discussed, to this old massive remnant scenario that I proposed long ago. But I guess you're saying that, when you come into this exotic star, the exotic stuff you find is, some spin network that doesn't look anything like classical space.
It's a superposition of geometries
sailing
of
past the surface.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So the star comes in, it gets to a quantum region. We call it Planck star when it enters the quantum region.
Well, the region that's outside the horizon, you might think of as like a stellar surface, analogous to a neutron star being outside the horizon, and you come in, you hit quantum geometry,
basically, is
what you're saying.
That's right. Yeah. Of course, there is a region, the quantum part doesn't start right at the horizon, well inside.
Well, it's probably quantum where the gap is between yellow and green outside the horizon, isn't that quantum too?
There's no horizon here. Where is the horizon? Yeah, so here it's already quantum outside the horizon.
Yeah, that little wedge outside.
Yeah. So after, if you sit near the black hole, for a long time everything is classical, but after a long, this is a very long time. This is m squared or m cubed. At some point something happens. That's important.
But for someone falling into the black hole, it can be instantly quantum.
For someone falling into the black hole, it still has a long time, long depending on mass, of the order n, to in which everything is completely classical, as you expect. At some point, you get to the, not to Planckian radius, but to the region where the curvature becomes Planckian. Here is when the density becomes Planckian, just too large.
But your argument is that weak curvature, but if you wait long enough time, that is inverse curvature, you expect to see something interesting.
I didn't get it, sorry.
So you have the criterion saying that the curvature times time should be L Planck inverse to make something interesting happen?
I am saying, it's two different things. That's right. I'm saying that if you take that criterion here, you don't need to do calculation. You just, dimensionally, you just look where things happen, and you get T of the order of n squared.
Yeah, but I'm saying that time is only applicable to someone who sits near the black hole.
Sure. The time here is always a local time. There's no global time.
If some observer just happened to start from far away and swim by, things go wrong for him very fast, and he doesn't see that coming from the curvature, local curvature.
That's a good point also, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I take this point even as a criticism in a sense. Yeah.
So I guess I want to come back to Joe's point. I mean, I think there is a curvature singularity at the tip of your wedge. You have a surplus angle. You've patched things together. I mean, I just called it normable. But I mean, yeah, you have more than 360 degrees around before you've added anything inside. So that's going to give you a delta function in the curvature at the tip. So you don't see it. The curvature doesn't blow up. And maybe you're saying you have one over R behavior as you approach it. But there is, I think, what you call delta is a singular point outside the horizon, which is the boundary of your quantum region.
Doesn't this depend on the details of the... I'm happy to...
I think the way you've constructed it, you're guaranteed that you're going to get a surplus angle there.
Because this line here and this line here converge?
Two pieces of structure that overlap.
But he might be arguing that he's regularizing that with some quantum geometry, whatever.
But the quantum geometry is supposed to only inside that region, not.
Well, does it include the point delta?
No.
I don't think it means.
I cut a few corners here, of course.
You can just cut a corner and make everything.
Yeah. Yeah. I. So.
Maybe the white region includes the point delta.
Exactly.
Carl, when you say this answer is wrong, is that just phenomenology?
Yeah, this angle is wrong. It's really phenomenology, because suppose this was true, then I make a prediction which a sufficiently big black hole, a sufficiently small black hole is going to explode in a second. Right. And we do see black holes. But let's suppose I take, like, this is the last transparency.
Real quickly. You said you were calculating the transition amplitude, right?
Yeah.
But how did you get the time out of the amplitude?
Ah, because, it's extremely beautiful. Because the time here is related to how distant this point is from 2m. That's actually the other answer. You can view this way. There's another way of viewing the geometry outside. Take a ball with a certain radius a, zero mass, with a mirror outside. and have a shell of light coming in, bouncing and bouncing out. Okay? Now I sit at a certain distance of it, and I want to know how long, for me, in my time, I'm a fixed radius, it takes the light to bounce on the mirror and come back to me. Of course, when the radius of the mirror gets close to 2m, 2m being the mass of the light, this becomes arbitrarily long. Okay? And this gives a logarithm. So you can view this in a sort of fake geometry, delta being the difference between 2m and the mirror radius. So when the mirror radius is 2m plus delta, the time outside is logarithmic. This is very small, and this is logarithmic in there. So once you understand that, you understand that in order to study this time here, you just need to know this delta. Okay. So you have a it's entirely determined by the.
So how does the amplitude give delta?
Because delta in turns determines the curvature of the surface here.
Is this a tunneling calculation, or is this classical evolution, Hamiltonian evolution?
It's a
statement that Hamiltonian evolution involves this ingoing shell to the outgoing shell.
Okay. It's a calculation in two steps. It's calculation in two steps. It's a classical metric in which you have a relation to some quantities. And answer the question by Ted was, what is the relation between this time outside and the geometry around here? That was one question. Okay. Once you have the geometry around here, the calculation is given a surface with a certain geometry here, and given a surface with a certain geometry here, okay, I want to have a quantum gravity calculation which associates to two geometries, intrinsic and extrinsic geometry, an amplitude of going from one to the other. The claim of the story, the tentative message of the talk, is that this is you're in a finite region of space-time, you know something about before and up, and you can compute transition amplitude. This transition amplitude in that particular case happen to depend on two parameters. So the way I'm using it is that when the probability is 1, I get an relation to
here. Say that amplitude is small, that would tell me that this ingoing shell would probably transition to some other state that's not this nice outgoing shell.
That's one way of viewing it. In fact, if I could do the full story here, I would be in a logic similar to Jim, in which you can go out to different geometries as possible.
Right. Is there some reason to think that this particular outgoing geometry would dominate or would have any appreciable support in the waveform? I mean, clearly, in some quantum gravity, there's going to be some transition amplitude that's not going to be zero. The issue is all the other things that you could transition to.
Well, yeah. Your question is possibly legitimate. This is in a much smaller context. I have when you do tunneling, standard tunneling, you say I can have the wave packet inside, the wave packet outside, or compute the probability for going from this classical solution to that classical solution. Track something and make a calculation saying that probability is large or small, depending on the time. I'm just doing this. So there is a classical solution outside, which I know, which depends on the parameter, time, bouncing time, and I want to do a calculation of transition from that to that and saying, is there a value of the parameter that makes the transition likely in quantum gravity? I'm not claiming that I have a general calculation of all possible. It's a very
what you have in quantum mechanics case that you're missing here is you know what the possible final states are. You know all the possible.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have anything.
You also know that the probability is always sum up to 1.
I don't know. I don't even know how to phrase here. Yeah. So let me just add the last two slides just to conclude.
I
have two slides, one summary slide and one final slide, and then I think zillions of things. So, but I care about this slide here because suppose this was true, and suppose m squared was a right solution, or m cubed was a right solution, then there is a very vague chance, but I want to talk about that, even with all the possible caveats that you can imagine, that this phenomenon will be observable. Why? Because if there are primordial black holes, then perhaps some of these primordial black holes might explode into A. If you have a mass to time, know the relation of mass time, from the Hubble time, it will be the mass. So you can say what is the mass of exploding black holes today. Now, if T is m cubed, what you get is signals in the cosmic ray spectrum. So very, very weak suggestion, could some of, you know, get cosmic rays for all sort of, could some of this be, in fact, primordial black hole exploding? But even more interesting, if T is m squared, which is my by far preferred scenario, it's a simple calculation. The exploding black hole today is in the centimeters. You wouldn't believe it, but if you take Planck numbers and Hubble time, you get centimeters. Centimeters means in the radio. And there happen to be signals called the fast radio bursts, that's one, which are very strong impulsive signals in the radio, in 20 centimeters, in fact, not centimeters, which the astronomers are very puzzled. They are extragalactic, their sources are unknown. So, of course, this is a wide speculation, it's throwing in the dark, but could some of this be, in fact, exploding?
Is the energy match? You've also got, you're...
Is a huge energy coming out, yes.
But you have wrote down an energy 10 to the 38 or the...
It's smaller than the energy of the black hole.
By what factor?
1 is 0.47,
and the black hole is 10 to the 47 Hertz. Mass, and you get it in basic 10 to the
so factor of
the centimeter is this internal time?
Centimeters
is internal times are redshift.
The wavelength, roughly the wavelength is the size of the exploding.
This internal time.
No, just the Schwarzschild of size.
Just the Schwarzschild radius. Just the Schwarzschild radius.
Well, the energy you have to know if it's beamed, right? The energy estimates you have to know if it's beamed in some direction. Do you know that?
I know nothing about the astrophysics of that. First, because I'm ignorant, and second, because this is so crude, this model here. I mean, this is a null shell collapsing in balance. And whatever happens in reality is not a null shell. It's rotating. It's a time-like and not light-like. Okay, so I just want to conclude the main message that I think the defense of being local, which is just forget infinity, forget the whole of space-time, you're here, you know some knowledge of what happens here, some knowledge of what happens here, you know the quantum gravitational calculation, you have a bulk boundary structure, but you can have a bulk boundary structure which is entirely determinative by the data on the boundary. And that's what I want to suggest could be a way of addressing local, in this particular sense, local can mean all sorts of things. These transition amplitudes are fully gauge invariant. There's nothing wrong in all this gauge invariants. Ignore infinity and don't need other complications. Of course, they have their own complication. So, let me start.
We should take a couple of questions and then take a break. Jim.
Well, I may have missed it, but where is the Hawking radiation?
Totally ignored. The logic is the following. If the bouncing time is m squared, which is what I hope, or even m cubed, let's say it's m squared, then it's a much faster phenomenon than the Hawking radiation. So there's this is a bouncing. So I take a ball, I let it go, it bounces up. Of course, it doesn't bounce out as far as I left it because there's some dissipation. So to first order, I disregard dissipation, and I have a mechanical, quantum mechanical bounce. Then, of course, this has to be corrected by there is dissipation, and in particular, there's Hawking radiation. So the Hawking radiation is going to correct whatever. I think if this phenomenon is real, it's dominating with respect to local radiation. Remember that local radiation, n cubed is immense, right? Because n here is m over n Planck. So for a stellar mass, time m cubed is a time n times a dimensional factor, which is the mass of the star in over micrograms, is immense. So the Hawking radiation is a very, very, very weak phenomenon. And I'm suggesting that when you work with Hawking radiation, you're disregarding quantum gravity, of course. I'm suggesting that in quantum gravity, there might be phenomena which come before you.
So would you predict, for example, black holes formed in the early universe would have no effect on the diffuse X-ray background? Would you then predict from this that black holes formed in the early universe, whatever they were, these would have no effect on the diffuse X-ray background, which was the original place people looked for the Hawking radiation, like a kink?
I don't know. Of course, yeah.
One interesting question is now to redo all the old calculation that has been done for primordial black holes, but now instead of considering a radiation coming from Hawking radiation, considering this new radiation coming from the explosion.
Yeah, I was just asking
ahead
of the calculations, I guess.
Okay, one more question, then we should continue the rest informally. So, many takers. How about someone who hasn't asked a question? Andrea.
Yeah, I was just wondering, if you allow a little bit of Hawking radiation, then you immediately lose unitarity, right? I mean, just by a little bit, maybe. Because your quantum corrected region is inside the horizon, so there's, if the Hawking evaporates a little bit, it doesn't take away information from the infalling shell, and so the outgoing shell after the bounce.
Yes and no. And in fact, I'm fighting with my younger philosopher. if you allow Hawking radiation, Hawking radiation goes out here, of course, right? But the standard story is a little bit changed because there's no one way of viewing the lack of unitarity is just the fact that you go from sky glass. The thing is unitary as macros by minus 2 sky glass times the light. It's mostly light. So here, everything that comes in can go out. Of course, it might be that there's still lack of unitarity because I'm disregarding the entanglement with geometry itself. It might happen there. It might be not claiming that I know it happens in unitarity of radiation. What some people did is to compute Hawking radiation in a two-dimensional approximation on this geometry. And what they claim is that the back reaction is large, but I don't... Sure. So they claim that you can redo the standard calculation on this geometry here instead of the standard one in which you just cut at here.
Okay, well, maybe we can discuss more of that informally. I guess you'll be here for a few more days.
I'm here for the week.
Yeah, okay, so there can be, certainly should be more discussion with Carla, but thanks again.
Thank you.